Thank you so much, Proclaim, for having me today. I'm so thankful to my brother Reese and Elise. Reese and I get to catch up maybe once a month or so, and it's just an absolute joy to have watched him over the last few months pray for you, prepare for you, do all of the things that require this setup. So, Reese and Elise, thank you for what you're doing in God's kingdom. We are going to be in Colossians chapter 3, so if you've got it looks like you've all got it open, which is amazing. We're going to go through it quite a lot, so keep your finger in that page. But before I start, I'm going to take a bit of a risk here. I'm going to do a fairly controversial poll with each of us. So raise your hand if you are a Star Trek fan. We've got some like hesitant people at the back. Raise your hand if you're a Star Wars fan. Oh, okay, here we go. Raise your hand if you couldn't care less at all. Oh, most of you. Okay, great. Well, this illustration is going to work perfectly then. I for the Star Wars fans that are out there, one of my favorite TV shows I'm watching at the moment is The Mandalorian. It's a new season 3 has just come out, and if you're not familiar with The Mandalorian, I'm not going to give any spoilers away, but it's one of those Star Wars spin-off shows, and it has all the things that you'd imagine in a Star Wars spin-off. It has the aliens, it's got the spaceships, it's got the lightsabers, it's got all that stuff, which is great. But one of the things I love about Star Wars is not just the spaceships and the action, it's actually the themes that are underneath it. I wonder how many of you know this, but all of the first movies of Star Wars, as much as it is about action and spaceships and alien invaders, is actually all about fatherhood. If you go back and watch it, it's all about, not just the Luke, I am your father, but all of it points to what it means to have a father, to lose a father. It's really interesting. The Mandalorian, I think I have a picture of the main character up on the screen. His name is Din Djarin, and what he is a Mandalorian, but he wasn't a Mandalorian by birth. You see, he was saved by the Mandalorians after his parents got caught up in a civil war. And when he became a Mandalorian, he joined this group as part of a creed. And one of the key parts of the creed is their armor and their weapons. And so he was given a helmet, given this armor, and one of the things he was told that he must not do is ever remove the helmet in public. Must never remove your helmet in public. And one of the interesting things about this whole series is that Din Djarin is trying to find out who he really is. He is a Mandalorian. He must not remove his helmet. But the theme is, throughout the series, is him trying to find out who he is actually underneath the helmet. What's his identity? And in Colossians chapter 3, we're going to have a look at what it actually means to be a Christian. We believe in Jesus. We believe that he is fully God and fully man. But what does that mean for us? What does that mean for the Christian? What's underneath the helmet of Christianity? So as we look into Colossians chapter 3, we're going to get under the helmet and we're going to ask three questions. The first one is, who are we really? Who are we really? Let's look at verse 1. It says, "If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on the things that are above, not on the things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory." So we learn very early on in Colossians that Paul is writing to a church plant, much like this one. He's been very encouraged by their faith, and yet he's also concerned about some of the outside influences that are coming into the church. In chapter 2, he warns them about certain religious practices. So things like eating particular foods, worshipping angels. He even talks about self-made religion. And so this false narrative that the world is imposing on this small Colossian church is that if you want to be close to God, here's what you do. You follow the law. You follow the rules and regulations. You abide by all of these. And once you do that, you'll have this divine identity, this divine community. And similarly today, I think we're being fed a similar narrative. But it's not one that's calling us to think about God. In fact, I think it's the complete opposite. I think it's what Paul calls this self-made religion. The false narrative today will tell us things like, look at technology, look at your gender, look at science, look at reason, look at tolerance. All of these things aren't bad, but see, the narrative, the false narrative is find your identity in these things, wrap your life around them. If you do this, then you'll be accepted. And if you don't, it's not that you won't be accepted, it's that you're actually unacceptable. And I think Paul tackles this false teaching of his day and ours by looking to something that's far more superior than man-made religion. You notice he says, if then you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is. So he's not saying, look at the world around you to find your identity. He's saying, actually, look up. Look up. There's something up there. And when we say up, well, I'm not saying something like in the sky or in heaven, but he's saying that there is a God that's created the universe and that's created you, and he has a purpose for you. To be with Christ, raised with Christ, it means you've been given an identity that allows you to see the world differently. It allows you to see the world through the lens of a death that brings life. Did you see in verse 3? It says, you have died. So for the Christian, in one sense, we're all dead. But in another sense, we've all been raised with Jesus. And it's because he died for you. He died because he saw a dying world. And at the end of our days, we will be in glory where Christ is. So Paul is trying to say that an identity in Christ, a Christ identity, is far more superior than a world identity. A Christ identity is more superior than a world identity. Which then we should ask another question, our second question for today. What does a Christ identity look like? Well, thankfully, Paul gives us some really concrete examples to this answer. Oftentimes in the Bible, we ask a big question and we don't have very specific things. But here, Paul is giving us some very specific instructions. You see, at the beginning of verse 5, he says, put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, evil passion, evil desire, covetousness, idolatry. He goes on and on and on. This put to death, or I might just call it the death list, right? These are things that he's calling Christians not to do. But not just not to do them, but actually work actively at not doing them. There's a lot of work involved there. In the beginning of verse 12, he says, put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy, beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, all these amazing virtues. He's saying, do these things. Now, as a young Christian, I wish someone had shown me this passage. Because when I became a Christian at about 15 or so, I thought I knew everything. Even when I became a Christian, I was like, okay, I know this Jesus thing. But what I thought I knew was that as long as I, you know, skirt up to the line of this death list and not cross over it, then that would be the Christian life. Get as close to not sinning as possible. But what that actually meant is that my life was filled with sexual sin and lying and cursing. All of these things that I thought were okay, not okay, but good enough. I basically committed all the don'ts as a young Christian. But Paul is actually giving us a lot more than just do's and don'ts. If you look back at verse 5, he actually kind of gives us a key to understanding this put to death list. He says, put to death what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, and here's the key, evil desire. Evil desire. That can be easy to read that word evil desire and think of some evil acts, that people might commit. Like we think you could think about people preying on the elderly. Maybe it's someone who breaks into a house. Maybe it's someone who does something really evil, like put anchovies on pizza, right? But that word for desire, or it's epithumia in Greek, it's actually used all over the Bible. And it's not an act we commit. I've got a slide that has Galatians chapter 5 on it. See how it uses desire here. It says, "But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other to keep you from doing the things that you want to do." So here, evil desire is actually not an act. It's a heart condition. It's a heart condition that leads you to do the things that you don't want to do, or that you do want to do. Have a look in James 1 as another slide. "But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin." See, evil desires of our heart precede the evil actions of our body. Jesus was the one that really came up with this idea. When he's interpreting the law at the beginning of his ministry, he uses lots of different examples to try and explain this. In Matthew chapter 5, which I think I've got on the screen as well, this is one of the things that Jesus talks about. He says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, for whoever murders will be liable to judgment.' But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment." Now, I haven't talked to a murderer before that I know of, but I imagine that the majority of them would be motivated by some sense of justice, right? Someone has wronged them, and then they decide they want to take justice into their own hands by doing something evil, murder. But they've taken a desire for a good thing, which is justice, and they've turned it into an evil thing, murder. But the question is, what is the real evil here? Jesus points this out. He says, of course murder is evil. But there's another real problem behind that. And that's the problem of the heart, a disordered desire in the heart. Tim Keller, one of my favorite preachers, he describes this word, desire, like this. He says, "The problem with our hearts," should be up on the screen too, "the problem with our hearts is not ordinary desire for bad things. It's over-desire for good things." So Paul's clue and his key as to why we participate in the put to death list is that our desires for good things, actually our over desires for good things, can reveal a disordered heart. And he uses the strongest term possible, doesn't he? Put it to death. Now, as Christians, we often celebrate our really good works. We celebrate people that come on over and give us a meal when we've been sick, or the group that has been praying together for those to come to know Jesus. We celebrate those, as we should. But I wonder if we should also celebrate the group of people, all of us really, who are putting sin to death. Right? How are you putting sin to death today? Maybe you've got a friend who's come to you and has revealed to you that they've just been struggling with pornography. We should celebrate the fact that that confession has come to them as they are putting that sin to death. Maybe you're meeting regularly with some trusted friends, just praying that God would help remove that desire for sin in your heart. We should be celebrating that. Maybe you're spending some consistent time in God's Word during the day and praying and spending time with God the Father. We should be celebrating that. And make no mistake, Paul is saying that there is a war going on in our hearts for the Christian, and to put to death these don'ts. But we are not in it alone. I think even if you just look around at the room today, this is a visual reminder that everybody in here, the person sitting next to you, they have a war going on in their heart. There are evil desires everywhere, but you are not in it alone. Paul gives us another way to put these things to death. If you have a look at verse 12, it says, "Put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts." Compassionate hearts. You see, he's saying that one way to put a disordered heart to death is to put on a compassionate heart. Now, I've mentioned before that I have three kids. Two of them are in school at the moment. And one of the hardest things that they do relating to school, it's not math, it's not Japanese, it's not literacy, it's not reading. It's actually putting on their school uniform in the morning, right? I will tell them, hey, can you go put your school uniform on? They'll go to their room, they'll like put pants on, and they'll start running after each other. Then I'll remind them again, they'll put one sock on, they'll chase each other again, they lose that sock in the process, and it goes under the couch. Did I mention this was hard for them? It's actually hard for me. It's hard for the parents, especially the compassionate heart part, right? But do you notice that in this passage, I want to point out two tools that Paul actually says can help us put on these compassionate hearts. Have a look at verse 15. It says, "And let the peace of Christ rule in your heart." Look down to verse 16. "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly." So when he says the peace, let the peace of Christ rule in your heart, this is Christ coming in to show you the way. And when he says, let Christ's word dwell richly, that word means Christ is coming in to make a home within your heart. And so you see these tools that Paul are giving us to put on compassionate hearts are actually not quite tools at all. It's a person. It's Jesus, your helper. But I know even with Jesus, there are some of us, maybe all of us, hear this and say, look, I know, I trust and believe in Jesus, but I'm really struggling with my sin. If Pastor Reese really knew what I was up to in the middle of the week, there's no way that he would think I'm a good Christian. Maybe you feel like you've messed up somewhere in your life and it's preventing you from having a relationship with God. So this should lead us to our final question. What if I fail at this? My childhood dream was to play in the NBA. And I was doing all the right things to do it. In fact, part of the reason that I moved over to the US was to go play college basketball. And I got to do that for 4 years. It was a wonderful experience. But that dream ended quite abruptly with some really bad injuries. You know, I was quite angry at God because I thought, oh, you've moved me over to the US to play basketball and to become this NBA superstar. It's the best league in the world. And when I become a superstar, I'll do all these things for you. I'll proclaim the gospel and I'll be so famous that I can do these things for you. Well, when it ended abruptly, I was quite upset. That was the end of my NBA dream. However, several years later, I had the opportunity to go to an NBA game and sit courtside. You see, we had some friends that had some friends that gave us some tickets, and it was an amazing experience getting to sit on the court, seeing some of your favorite players play. In fact, we were watching the Dallas Mavericks, my favorite team. One of my favorite players, Dirk Nowitzki. Anyone know Dirk Nowitzki in here? One guy. Thank you, Reese. He was an amazing player. And we were having a great time. But there was this one moment during the game where the ball just flew out of bounds and it landed right in my lap. And the ref blew the whistle. One of the teams had called a timeout. So all the players go back to their benches and I'm here holding the ball. But not Dirk. Dirk starts walking towards me. And he's motioning to me to pass him the ball. So I pass him the ball. He turns around. He shoots a practice shot. It goes in. I've just given Dirk Nowitzki an assist. My NBA dream has come true. Now, there's a point to tell for me telling you the story. But before I tell you the point, I want you to look at verse 17. You go down to the toward the end of chapter 3. It says, "Whatever you do in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. This passage is the mission statement of the entire letter to the Colossians. It's the call for Christians to focus all of our energy, all of our action, commit all the purpose of our lives to Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. But I'll return to my question. What if we fail at this? What if we don't live up to that? Well, here's the deepest reality for Christians. We are going to fail at this. Your skills, your achievements are not going to be enough to get you onto the court. You're not, as Christians, we've been given a very exclusive place. We've been gifted a place, but it's not on the sideline. It's actually on the court. It's actually more than on the court. You're not just a part of a team. You're a part of a family, the family of God. And so your efforts aren't driven by your own skill set, by your own might and power, and it's certainly not driven by your ability to not fail. Your efforts are driven by grace, by the grace of the creator of the universe who has looked upon us and has removed us from our sin as far as the east is from the west. Look at what Paul has to say in Philippians 2. I'll put this up on the screen too. He says, "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is who that works in you? It's God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure." So as we work out our salvation, it's God who is working in us to his good pleasure. God is pleased to work through our failures. He's pleased to work through our mess-ups because it's grace that is fueling that in us. This is an incredible, incredible promise. See, to put on this identity, this Christ identity, we are going to have to work at it. We are going to have to put in effort. But it's not driven by us. In fact, it is driven by the one who had nails driven into his hands. It's driven by the man who saw all the ways that we could fail, and he knew we would never live up to God's standard. But he did say, "I'll take their place. I'll take the punishment that they deserve. I'll give them a new family. I'll give them a new life." And he did that by death on a cross. And when he rose from the grave, victorious over death, do you remember what he said to his disciples? Or one of the things he said? He said, "Go out into the world and proclaim the gospel to all the nations." With Jesus' death on the cross, it doesn't just save you from your sin. It certainly does. But God's actually saying, "You are so worthy because of what Christ has done. I want you to come be a part of this mission." He's called us into the game. He's called us into the work of the gospel. You are doing that, proclaimed church. You have committed to an incredible body of believers who has seized the vision, sees this area, and says, "God, man, God has called me into the game." And it's so encouraging to see. And yes, it takes effort. But I love what author Don Carson calls the Christian effort. He says that it is grace-driven effort. Grace-driven effort. So when you feel like you're failing at parenting or you're failing at school, I want you to remember that Christ has died for you because he loves you. And it's his grace that is fueling you forward. So when you try and try and try again to put evil desires and sin to death, and you're trying to put on a compassionate heart, let me tell you, keep going. Keep going. Because you have been raised with Christ if you're a Christian. Your life is fueled by his grace. When we fail, it's not because our efforts are failing us. It's God that's working in us by his grace. And to the extent that you're able to see that your efforts are driven by grace, you'll actually get to see that every effort you make to put sin to death and to put on a Christ-like heart and to tell others the good news of Jesus won't just bring God glory, but he will flourish your soul. I'm going to ask Rhys and Elise, we didn't plan this earlier, but if you guys want to come up and start to lead us in worship, I want to take a moment to speak personally to those in here who you might feel like you're drowning. I've been there so many times. In fact, already this year, having a newborn, it's a big adjustment, right? It's a big change. And oftentimes in my faith, I can feel like, how am I going to get over this hump? Maybe you want to see grace at work in your life, but there's something blocking it. Maybe it's some unconfessed sin. It might be shame over something you've done. It might be the busyness of life that's overcome your world. Well, I want to leave you with a couple of words of Jesus from John chapter 10. It says, so Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. Jesus says, I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy, but I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. Friends, Jesus has not come to condemn you. He has come to love you. He is the door. He is the way. And he is the one that's come to give you life and life abundantly. If you've never considered that before, if you've never considered these promises of Jesus, I pray that you would see that Christianity isn't a religion that judges you by what you do, but it's actually a way of life that's driven by God's grace. So I just want you to take a moment where you are at the moment. You can bow your heads if you like, but I want you to take a second just to consider, where is God working in your life right now? Where is that sin that might be holding you back from connecting with God the Father? Take a quiet moment in prayer and remember that Jesus' grace is there for you.